I'm very pleased to see so many people in here on what is probably the warmest and sunniest day it's been in months. Happens to be St. Patrick's Day, too, and I was joking with our guest today. I had the pleasure of introducing him, Professor Joe Nye. I was joking with him that there might be as many people in Gertz right now as there are going to be at his talk, but I think we actually outdid Gertz, so very happy about that. It is a pleasure to have Professor Nye here today, a pleasure on many counts. Professor Nye is one of the best examples we have of someone who has distinguished himself in several different fields and bounced back and forth between academia and policymaking. It's hard to think of anyone who's done as good a job in both those areas, contributed so much in both those areas as Professor Nye. I can think about many things. I'm thinking about pulling off the, looking at the dust cover on his jacket here, the jacket of the new book, The Future of Power, that just came out. There's a long list of things to say here. He's currently University Distinguished Service Professor at Harvard and former dean of the Kennedy School of Government, but he's also served in the U.S. government for as Deputy Undersecretary of State for Security Assistance, Science, and Technology. He chaired the National Security Council Group on Nonproliferation of Nuclear Weapons, and then he was chairman of the National Intelligence Council as well, and he served in some other positions, and he received distinguished service awards for his work in the U.S. government. He also served as U.S. representative to the U.N. Secretary General's Advisory Committee on Disarmament Matters, and for his academic work, he's been rewarded by being made a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the American Academy of Diplomacy, the British Academy. He's a recipient of Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson Award, the Charles Merriam Award, and Distinguished Scholar Award from the International Studies Association, which is a convention that's meeting here in Montreal right now. I'm going to say a little bit about what he's done academically and how it's touched some of us, including myself, in a moment. But first, I'm going to thank some of our sponsors, and I'll start with actually Carly Grossman from the Faculty of Arts and the Development Fund, who helped organize this. Thank you for doing that work and helping advertise it. Obviously, that's had a good effect, so thank you very much. The Institute of European Studies, which is a joint venture between the University of Montreal and McGill. And then, of course, most importantly, Bombardier, for giving us the money to pull all these things together. And more specifically, I'd like to thank Annette Kopek and Danielle Boudreau from Bombardier Business Aircraft, and then also Hélène Gagnon from Bombardier Aerospace. And Hélène is going to come up and say a few words here in a moment. She is the Vice President in charge of communications, public relations, and corporate social responsibility for Bombardier Aerospace. And so I'll pass the mic to you for a moment.
Thank you, Mark. For a company like Bombardier, we're a multinational, of course, and we sell aircraft to many, many countries in the world. So emerging countries is something that we care about a lot, and therefore it's really a pleasure and an honor to be able to participate and contribute in a very small way to help organize this event. I'm very pleased to see your interest as well in emerging markets. Just a few words, perhaps, on corporate social responsibility at Bombardier. So the idea of this lecture series was actually to get some very interesting content for a magazine that we do for our customers, our business aircraft customers. And you'll say, business aircraft, corporate social responsibility, do they really go well together? Well, we try to make sure that they do go well together. And last year, we actually rallied all of our competitors in that market to make a commitment to reduce the carbon footprint of business jets. So we are doing our part, and this is what we're trying to do with the magazine, to actually talk about corporate social responsibility to the corporations and people that buy business jets. So this is one area. And I'd like to apologize to Professor Nye and to all of you, because I will need to leave before the end of this this lecture, because we are actually hosting a ceremony with ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization, not far from here today. I'm presenting a model of the C-Series, and I'm sure you've heard of the C-Series. It's going to be a very green aircraft in its class, and reducing the carbon footprint by 20%. And with the prices of fuel going up these days, I think it's going to be something very important for airlines and all of us in the future. So on that note, I will turn it back to Mark, and thank you very much for your interest in corporate social responsibility in emerging markets, and rest assured that the companies that are here, not far from here, headquartered from here, do care about that, and we try to improve and do our part for the planet every day. Thank you.
Thank you. So as a segue into the talk itself, I'd like to say a little bit about what Professor Nye has done academically, and I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with a few of his concepts. He's written on the notion of soft power and how soft power can be employed. He's also written about the paradox of American power. There's another book on that. I'm going to mention perhaps an older one, reflecting my age. The first book that I used as a textbook in a class on international political economy, and I know a lot of you are my students out there who have sat through my courses on international political economy, the first textbook that I ever had as a student was Power and Interdependence, so a book that Professor Nye wrote with Robert Cohen. And then, I have to say, as an instructor, when I first started teaching some of those large undergraduate courses, I struggled with a couple of textbooks. At that point, I was not teaching the same course that I teach now. I was teaching a course that was much more straightforward, international relations. And I was struggling to find a textbook that sort of had the right balance and got to the topics but was accessible and so forth. And along came a new textbook called Understanding International Conflict. The students were happy because it appeared to be thin and therefore easy. It was not. It was easy to read, though. It was incredibly accessible, and when I started thinking about my own writing that was geared towards textbooks, books for students, I very much tried to think of the style that Professor Nye writes with and try to copy that approach and make things simple and clear and to the point. And I think if you're interested in finding out the new book, it's exactly the same. It is incredibly, I mean, the quotes on the back actually tell a lot about it. They use words like lucid, insightful, persuasive, readable, incredibly easy to get the big ideas that are in this book. So with that, no pressure there to give us a really accessible talk, clear, accessible talk. Are you going to use the...
Should I stand or what? Probably better to stand. The more visible the back or lines. Doesn't matter. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Mark, and it's a real pleasure to be here at McGill and to give the Bombardier lecture. I appreciate the generosity of the introduction, but I am always reminded that when my three sons were growing up and people would call the house and they'd say, "Is Dr. Nye there?" and they'd also say, "Yes, but he's not the useful kind." So it's forewarning for what's to come. This question of international governance and emerging markets is an extraordinarily important one. And to understand it, we have to have an idea of what's happening to power in the world. And in this new book, The Future of Power, that Mark kindly mentioned, I argue that there are two big power shifts going on in the world today. One is a shift of power among states, which could be called, I call it power transition, and it could be called the recovery of Asia or the rise of the rest. It's very much a shift from west to east, And if you think about that, imagine that you had a snapshot of the world in 1800, and you said, how is population and product distributed in the world? Asia was more than half of the world's population and more than half of what the world produced. Now, if you fast forward to 1900, you'd see Asia is still more than half of the world's population, but only roughly 20% of what the world produced. The world economy had shifted, and what had happened was not something that happened to Asia. It was the Industrial Revolution in Europe and North America that brought about that change. And what we're seeing now is what you might call return to normal. Somewhere in the middle of this century, Asia will be half of the world, more than half of the world's population, and more than half of the world's product. So those are more normal proportions. It begins with Japan. It moves on to Korea, and then it moves on to some of the Southeast Asian nations, and now everybody's focused on China, but soon they'll be focused on India. And this is a major shift or change in the distribution of power in the world. So that's one of the big shifts, and I'm going to come back to that. But let me also add a bit about Brazil, which doesn't fit the East-West, but does fit this rise of the rest. Let me mention the other big shift that in power that's happening in the 21st century, and that's what I call power diffusion. And that's a movement of power away from all governments, East or West, to non-state actors, non-governmental actors. And that is quite new. I mean, not totally new, but with power transition among states, we've seen it happen before. Power diffusion, yes, there's been some before, but nothing like what we're seeing today. Let me give you a couple of examples to lock this in your mind before we turn back to power transition and then talk about governments where we pull the two together. The way to think about power diffusion is to see the extraordinary impact of the information revolution upon who can participate in world politics. If you think about what's happened to the price of computing power, it dropped a thousandfold in the last quarter of the 20th century. Now, that's a very abstract number, but think of it this way. If the price of automobiles had dropped as rapidly as the price of computing power, you could buy a car today for $5. Anytime something goes down in price that dramatically, the barriers to entry into that market are, they're nothing. Again, to give you a concrete example, if you wanted to have a capacity, let's say in 1970 or 75, to communicate instantaneously between Montreal, Johannesburg, Brasilia, Beijing, and New Delhi, and Moscow, you could do it. You could do it then. It was technologically possible, but it was very expensive. You needed to be a government or a large corporation to have the kind of budget that would tolerate that. Now, any of you can do that for free on Skype. I mean, it's that simple. And if you reduce the barriers to entry, then everybody can play in the game. So what you've seen in this diffusion of power is that this information revolution is bringing everybody into the game. Now, sometimes people say information revolutions aren't new. That's true. Gutenberg's printing press was an information revolution, and eventually it led to the Protestant Revolution, when people say, I don't have to listen to my priest or the Pope tell me what's in the Bible, I can read it myself. That was a huge effect. It took 100 years or so. If you look at the information revolution today, what's striking is not just how rapidly it's happened, but this democratization, how cheap it is, how easy it is for everybody to get in the game. So the net effect of this in terms of power diffusion is that it's not that governments are no longer the largest or most significant actors in world politics, but they're playing on a stage that's a lot more crowded. And that means a very different type of politics. Let me give you a few examples. It means that you've got a lot of people who can do things they couldn't do before. Some of that is good, some of it's bad. So you have international non-governmental actors who, like Oxfam, who can do a lot of good for what's happening in third world countries. You have also organizations like Al-Qaeda who can do a lot of bad in terms of doing damage. Or another example would be what's happened in Egypt in the last 6 weeks or so. It used to be the conventional wisdom that when you looked at Egypt or Tunisia or the Middle East, you said there were two poles. You either had to support the autocrats like Mubarak, or you wound up with the religious fanatics like the Muslim Brotherhood, and there was no choice. What this enormous diffusion of power has done as a result of the information revolution is created a new middle in Egyptian politics. And not only were there a new group of people who were out there in Tahrir Square, but they were provided with tools through Twitter and Facebook and so forth, which allowed them to solve the problem of how do you coordinate collective action. And suddenly, the politics of Egypt were transformed. Or to give you yet another example of how diffusion of power is progressing, think of WikiLeaks, which, people could always steal information. There's a long tradition of espionage in world politics. But the idea that somebody could take 250,000 State Department cables from around the world and distribute them globally in an instant, that's really quite different. Or finally, as an example of diffusion of power, think about cyber power. I have a chapter in this book on cyber power. In the past, if somebody wanted to attack you, presumably they had to get inside your country, they had to cross the border, or send an airplane or a missile across the border or something. Now they can sit at home and send an electron. And these electrons can do you enormous damage. We're all familiar with the idea of this Stuxnet worm, which has interfered with the working of centrifuges in Iran on their nuclear program. But, Stuxnet that was probably done by governments, we don't know. But Stuxnet could also be done by a government to us, or could be done by a non-governmental actor. So somebody finds out that the electricity system in Montreal is closed down in February, and I think you have some idea that that have about the same effect as a bomb going off in terms of frozen pipes and so forth. Who did it? There's a famous cartoon that was in the New Yorker magazine a decade or so ago, which has one dog talking to another dog in front of a computer. And the first dog says to the second dog, "Don't worry, on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog." Well, that was a very prescient cartoon, because when the control system which governs electricity in Montreal goes out, you don't know whether it was done by a government, whether it was done by a terrorist group, whether it was done by an individual hacker, just for the hell of it. And you also, when you first try to trace it, it may not be what you think. It may come through a computer in China. The University of Toronto has done a lot of very good work on GhostNet, which is a Chinese oriented system for tracking, attacking and spying on political types. But it could also be somebody in Taiwan who wanted to stir up trouble between, let's say, Canada and China or U.S. and China. You don't know this. So if you think about the diffusion of power, this information revolution and the way it's playing out is really a very new dimension in politics. And I want you to hold that in your mind, because I want to come back to this in the end. about why this is important when we think about global governance and the emerging powers. But let me now turn back to power transition, which is the movement of power among states. And there, I think the big question we have to ask ourselves is, do we know how to think about all this in a sensible way? In some ways, the traditional way in which people thought about power tended to focus heavily on military and economic power, what I call hard power, and not enough on soft power. Now, power is simply the ability to affect others to get what you want. You can do it in three ways. You can do it with coercion, sticks. You can do it with payments, carrots. Or you can do it with attraction and persuasion, which is what I call soft power. But much of what we talk about when we talk about power today tends to be old-fashioned. There was a great Oxford historian named A.G.P. Taylor who wrote a fascinating book on the struggle for mastery of Europe in the 19th century. And he said, the mark of a great power is the capacity to win at war. But you know what? In a global information age, it might matter as much whose story wins as whose army wins. And that ability to construct a narrative which attracts others to work with you may be as important or perhaps more important than the ability to send a bomb or a missile or what have you and prevail in war. Now, if you look at this question then of power transition, a lot of what people are talking about power transition today is sometimes described as American decline, which I think is not a very helpful way of putting about it. I think a better way of thinking about it is of power transition among states is what you might call the rise of the rest. In other words, it's not necessarily something which is going on in America that we have to look at. It's what happens outside, just as in the 19th century it wasn't what was happening in Asia, it was what's happening outside that led to this great power shift of the 19th century. And in the sense of looking at the rise of the rest, it's interesting that around 2000, Goldman Sachs, the investment bank, coined the phrase BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And they pointed out that what was happening in the world markets was that in the year 2000, the BRICS were responsible for basically about 16% of world product. And by 2008, just before the Great Recession, they had increased their share up to 22%. And in the last couple of years, in the Great Recession, many of the BRICS, particularly not Russia, but Brazil, India, and China, did very well. China kept 10% growth rates, India at about 8% growth rates, Brazil at about 5% growth rates. These are very important. So it means that their share of the world economy is continuing to increase. Now, one problem with this concept of BRICS, however, is that Russia really doesn't belong in it. Russia is if you want, not an emerging market. It's a advanced economy, but an advanced economy in decline. Russia has three very major problems. One is it tends to be dependent on one type of export only, which is energy, oil and gas. It hasn't got the diversity that goes with, let's say, being a major power in the information age. If you look at India and Bangalore and its participation in the information economy globally, Russia doesn't have that. The other thing that Russia has a problem with is demography. Russians are dying out. The interesting thing about Russia is that the average age of a Russian male, the average age of death of a Russian male is 59. That's appalling. There's no other developed country in the world that has a problem like that. And the net effect of this is that demographically, Russia is continuing to decrease. And then the third problem that Russia has is extraordinarily political corruption and institutional rigidity. The best source of this is to read the speeches of Medvedev, the Russian president. And what Medvedev says is, unless we modernize, we're not going to succeed. And yet every time he tries to modernize, he runs up against very corrupt vested interests and can't do anything about it. So the concept of BRICS really ought to be dropped, and you ought to take Russia out and put Indonesia in. Then you'd have a much more useful concept for understanding emerging markets. But in one of the great ironies of the power of narrative, Goldman Sachs invented this term, emerging markets and BRIC, BRICS to represent investment opportunities. But then the countries themselves began to take it seriously. So they've now had two BRICS summits. And the BRICS summits, they get together. They got together in Russia, at Yekaterinburg. Now, last year it was in Brasilia. And they've taken this acronym, which was coined by an economist at Goldman Sachs, Jim O'Neill, for convenience of investors to simplify markets, but primarily financial markets, not real markets. And they've elevated it into an international organization. Now, where does that fit in governance? They can't agree on much. There are deep differences between these countries. Russia is worried about Chinese incursion into Siberia. India is very concerned about the rivalry with China, China less so. And Brazil essentially is off by itself. It has a different set of interests and problems. But nonetheless, it's given rise to sort of a reification of the concept of BRICS. If one looks carefully at the concept of BRICS, with the exception of Brazil, which has been growing at 5% and has about $10,000 per capita income, which is very impressive, and 90% literacy. But with the exception of Brazil, most of the substance of what's in the BRICS is China. It's Asia, and within Asia, it's particularly China. And China has been growing at an extraordinary rate. For the last 30 years, China has been growing at close to double-digit growth over the whole period. There have been a few setbacks in that period, but nothing too terribly serious. And this is, I think, a very good thing for the world. What's happened is the Chinese have managed to raise 300 or 400 million people out of poverty. That's a good thing. And so China deserves a lot of credit for that. But there's still another 300 or 400 million to go. And so China is in this paradoxical situation of growing extremely rapidly. And everybody then is saying, this is the powerhouse of the future. It's the wave of the future. But as the British economic journalist Martin Wolf wrote in the Financial Times, China is a premature superpower. He also used the same thing for India. Very impressive growth, but if China is a premature superpower with per capita income at about $6,000 per head in purchasing power parity, India is a premature, but also about 95% literacy. India is a very much a premature superpower in the sense that it is not only well behind China in terms of its overall economic size, but it suffers terribly from the fact that its literacy rate is around 67%. And for women, it's even worse. So India, while it's gotten on this trajectory that I described earlier as the recovery of Asia and is making good progress, and nobody should devalue 8% growth, it has a terrible problem of basically the two different Indias, this enormous inequality. And still, and as I mentioned earlier, still so does China. The Gini index, which measures inequality in countries, in China has been increasing. It's over 0.5, which is very high in terms of measurements of inequality. So as we look at these economies, we realize that we've got to be careful not to assume that because of the things that make headlines, China becomes the world's largest exporter, China builds high-speed rail, China does this, that, or the others, that the problems are all gone. Now, why is this important? Because a lot of people are now casting this narrative of the rise of China as the decline of the U.S., and so they have an image of sort of the U.S. has been the top dog. Britain was the top dog, then the U.S. becomes the top dog, now China's becoming the top dog, and that's the story of what will happen to governance in the 21st century. I think that's mistaken for a couple of reasons. To cast this as a narrative of American decline is mistaken because it mixes up two terms. When you talk about decline, you can imagine absolute decline, and you can imagine relative decline. Absolute decline would be a situation like what occurred to ancient Rome. Rome declined, remember it took about 300 years for Rome to decline from its peak to its collapse. Rome declined not because it was overtaken by another state or empire. It declined through internal decay and then succumbed to an onslaught of barbarians. But the internal decay was the product of a not only internecine warfare and strife, but a stagnant economy. Rome had an agrarian economy with no productivity growth, and the net effect of that was that eventually Rome became overextended and declined. Whatever else you can say about the United States, low productivity and stagnation is not the case. I mean, growth in the United States is now about 3%, and for the last 2 years, particularly after the recession, it was negative. But that was a cyclical effect, not a secular effect. If you look at the productivity of the American economy, something like the World Economic Forum in Davos, which does an annual rating of the called the World Competitiveness Index, rates the United States at the fourth most competitive economy in the world today, behind Switzerland, Sweden, and Singapore. China, for comparison, is 27th, and Brazil and India would be 20, 30 points below that, just to give you an example of comparisons on this. So the image of the United States as absolute decline. Americans have a huge amount of problems, I mean, budget deficit, the better educational system, there are lots of these things. But to portray this as absolute decline in the Roman sense doesn't make sense. On the other hand, if you look at relative decline, the rise of the rest means that others are getting closer to America. The gap between America in GDP or in overall power and others is less than it was. So you could call that relative decline, but what's interesting is even if the others get closer, doesn't mean they're necessarily going to be more powerful than the U.S. in any one-on-one comparison. So this narrative that we use to explain what's happening in power transition, which is the recovery of Asia and within that the rise of China, which will replace the United States as a story of decline, is not very helpful for us to understand what's happening with these emerging economies, and particularly the Chinese. Let me give you some specifics here. Goldman Sachs projects that China will equal the size of American GDP by 2027. That's quite plausible. It might even happen sooner. After all, one country is growing at 10%, another and has 1.3 billion people, and another is growing at 3%. as 300 million people, sooner or later those lines are going to cross. But even when they cross sometime in the 20s, assuming that that's accurate projection, equality in size is not equality in composition. And you measure the composition of an economy by GDP per capita, which is a much more sophisticated judgment of the nature of an economy. And on GDP per capita, China's not going to equal the United States until sometime in the 2040s or so, if then. And remember, I'm using China as the most advanced of the emerging economies, sort of the heart of the BRICS, that concept. The other point that is in looking at China and American power is this projection doesn't look at military power or soft power that I mentioned earlier. And China is not going to be equal to the U.S. in military power for another decade or two, if then. And in soft power, China has considerable problems of developing attraction because of the authoritarian nature of their internal system. It's true that sometimes people will say that the Beijing consensus of authoritarian capitalist growth has replaced the Washington consensus. And that's true. It does mean that you have an appeal of the Chinese models in places like Zimbabwe and Venezuela. But when you ask, what about Chinese soft power in democratic countries, you find that every time China gets credit for, let's say, the Beijing Olympics or the Shanghai Exposition, when they go and lock up somebody like Liu Xiaobo and prevent him from going to the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony, they essentially undercut that soft power that they've created. So China is not going to be equal on military and soft power. But the other point that's important is that when we talk about the rise of Asia, it's remember recovery of Asia, it's remember Asia is not one thing. And that China has a problem, which is that as its hard power increases economically and militarily, it frightens its neighbors. So you find that what's happened in the last few years in Asia is countries like Japan, India, Vietnam, and others, South Korea, want basically an American presence. And that means that the Chinese have a problem, which is the geopolitical situation in East Asia is very different, let's say, from geopolitics of North America. It would be as if Canada and Mexico were making alliances with China to balance American power, and we don't see that. So these projections that you see as in headlines, emerging markets about to take over, China about to pass a declining America, and so forth, they're not very helpful in terms of understanding what's going on. Now, you might say, well, who cares? Why worry about it? Is this just sort of claiming rights to claim your number one? No. Power is not good or bad per se. It's like calories in your diet. Too little of it, you expire. Too much of it, you become obese. The real question here is that if people misunderstand these changing power relations, it may lead to disastrous policies. Let me give you an example. Many Chinese now believe the United States is in decline. If you read Chinese writings, there are lots of articles about the decline of the U.S. And that may mean that China misjudges how hard it should push on things. So that if the Americans want to compromise with China on something, they offer a compromise position, the Chinese might say, it proves what we said. The United States is in decline, which means the Americans then feel reluctant to compromise. Alternatively, if the Americans think that it's a question of decline and the rise of China, they may become too fearful and not be able to make the compromises that are necessary. And this would not matter terribly, except that we have examples in history when you've had one power rise and create fear in another, which creates a huge problem in terms of policy. Thucydides explained the Peloponnesian War, which is the great conflict in which the Greek city-state system tore itself apart as caused by the rise in the power of Athens and the fear it created in Sparta. And many people say that was the story of World War I, which tore the European state system apart, which was the rise in the power of Germany and the fear that created in Britain. And some argue that's going to be the story of the 21st century. The rise in the power of China will create fear in the United States, which will lead to a great conflict. I think this is wrong, and it's also bad history. It's bad history because if you believe what I said earlier, China is not about to pass the United States, whereas Germany had passed Britain economically by 1900, which means that there's plenty of time for the Americans and the Chinese to work out their relationship. It doesn't have to lead to this kind of a conflict. And we don't want to begin to believe that a conflict is inevitable, because the belief in the inevitability of conflict itself becomes a cause of conflict. One way to summarize this and then bring it to global governance is that if you look at the world today, power is distributed differently in different contexts or domains. Think of a three-dimensional chess game where you play horizontally and vertically. On the top board, the board of military relations among the states, the world is unipolar. The United States is the only country with great capacity to project military power globally. I think it's probably going to remain that way for another couple of decades. I don't see the Chinese passing on that. But if you go to the middle board of economic relations among states, the world is multipolar. Here is where Europe can act as an entity. And when Europe acts as an entity, its economy is larger than that of the United States. And you also have China and Japan and Brazil and the other emerging markets playing a greater role. And American power can be balanced here. But now go to the bottom board of this three-dimensional chess game, the board of transnational relations, things across borders outside the control of governments, whether it be Al-Qaeda or huge financial flows or cyber terrorism or impersonal processes like global climate change or pandemics. Power is chaotically distributed. Nobody is in charge. This is the area where diffusion of power begins to play and the non-state actors become particularly important. Now, the reason that's important is the only way in which you can deal with these issues from this bottom board of transnational relations is through soft power and cooperation, the development of institutional networks. And that means you have to have a different view of global politics. We often talk about power over other countries, but there's also power with other countries. So if you want to deal with climate change, for example, the idea that you could deal with climate change by bombing Chinese coal-burning plants. China produces 2 coal-burning plants a week, which has a huge impact on us in the long run. And China is now the CO2 of superpower. They passed the U.S. But the idea that you would deal with this in a 19th century fashion of bombing Chinese coal plants makes no sense. Nor does it make sense to have an embargo against Chinese trade until China stops building coal plants. That would be destructive to the international commercial system. So you have to think of how can we work with China to help them reduce the carbon intensity of their growth. That's an empowerment of China, but it's good for us too. So we've got to have to learn to think at the same time that we have competitive relations, for example, relations with Chinese Navy in the South China Sea, we also have to have cooperative relations to deal with these new issues that arise from the diffusion of power. And that brings me to this problem of what do we think about global governance. We're going to need to find ways to produce global public goods, things which benefit everyone. And the great problem with global public goods, with any public goods, is they're underproduced because everybody tends to want a free ride. Let the other guy put the investment in, you know, if we can get the benefits without having to pay for it. And classically, large powers, as Britain was in the end of the 19th and the early 20th century, tend to do more on producing global public goods because they tend to benefit more. So freedom of the seas, the British produced, relative monetary stability under the gold standard the British produced, a degree of open free trade the British produced because it was good for Britain, but it was good for others as well. The problem with this, of course, is that as the United States replaced Britain as the greatest power after World War I economically, it didn't live up to that responsibility. It was a free rider. And basically, there was nobody sort of mending or maintaining the international economic system in the 1930s, and we had a Great Depression as a result. One of the key questions today is, will the emerging economies free ride the way the Americans did in the 1920s? Will they essentially play the role that they need to play in contributing to the production of global public goods? Well, for India and Brazil, as I mentioned earlier, they're considerably behind China. So let's look at the test case of China. Robert Zoellick, the president of the World Bank, said that we had to persuade China to become a responsible stakeholder. But the Chinese basically still are very much free riders. And how long will it take for Chinese attitudes to realize that production of global public goods is now in their interests and that free riding isn't? And that's going to be a big problem for how we think about global governance. We should get away from the idea of global government. We're not going to have global government. But we do have global governance, everything from ICAO, as mentioned earlier, to the World Trade Organization, to the International Atomic Energy Agency. There's a whole lot of institutions and networks which produce global governance. But they still require states, and particularly large states, to take the lead in making them effective. In other words, it's not enough just to set up an institution. You still have to have somebody who takes the lead on this. One of the hard problems here is, if you look ahead to the world of 2040, the three biggest countries in the world in 2040 will be, by population, India, China, US. By power, overall, all dimensions, military, economic, and soft power, I suspect it will be US, and whether it'll be India, probably China, but India or China, but in that type of order. But one thing to notice about these three countries is all of them are very jealous of their sovereignty. Unlike the Europeans, who essentially have gone beyond a Westphalian world in which everybody jealously guards their sovereignty, these large countries I mentioned tend to be very jealous of sovereignty, which makes it harder for them to make the compromises and to take the leads that we need to have these networks of governance work as well as they should. There's another problem that goes with this, which is simply the size that goes with the complexity that goes with size. The UN is an indispensable institution, but one of the problems it has is that there's some things it can do and other things it can't do. And it can't do a lot of detailed negotiation at a number of states reaching 192. Witness the unfortunate outcome of the Copenhagen talks on climate change. And it's a very simple proposition that we have to think about, which is, how do you get everybody into the act on global governance and still get action? If we think of three countries dealing with each other, there are three pairs of relationships. If we think of 10 countries dealing with each other, there are 45 pairs of relationships. If we think of 100 countries dealing with each other, there are 5,000 pairs of relationships. So you can quickly see how difficult it becomes to go to the UNFCCC, the body for negotiating climate change, and get an agreement. On the other hand, if you think about the major economies forum, which is a group of about 8 economies, will treat Europe as one for this purpose, that produces 80% of greenhouse gases, and it's 10. And there, you can imagine negotiations in that smaller setting. So we are going to have to think of what the Europeans have called variable geometry as we think about international institutions and networks. There isn't going to be one size fits all. You're not going to be able to have the UN handle everything. We need the UN for the largest organization for legitimacy, for handling crisis situations, the Security Council role in peacekeeping, and so forth. But when it comes to managing these issues that grow out of diffusion of power, this bottom chessboard, which presents to us some of the greatest problems we're going to face in this century, climate change, pandemics, cyber terrorism, and so forth, we basically are going to have to think of more flexible networks and somewhat smaller networks. And in that sense, we're also going to have to be much more aware of the importance of soft power for organizing cooperation in these networks to deal with this. So to summarize or to conclude, in a global information age, we need new narratives of how we understand what's happening in the world today. Narratives about hard power, narratives about decline and one country replacing another. These are not the ways in which we need to think. We need to ask, how are we going to organize networks of global governance so that we can deal with both the rise of the rest and the diffusion of power? And we're not there yet, but we'd better get there because this is going to be the great question for governance in the 21st century. So let me stop there and throw it open for your questions or even rebuttals, happily. So, over to you. Have a question near the back.
My question is related to your comment about BRICS and what happened about 33 years ago about the MPA. MPA 33 years ago stemmed from Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina. So far, they say that, or at least I thought that is what they say is the future. And 33 years later, we saw that Brazil graduated from the top of BRICS. Mexico, what happened in Mexico is they got the wealthiest richest man on the earth, and a lot of countries. And Argentina, up and down, they keep singing the song, so fine for me, Argentina. So do you see the comparison of the French, which are a lot of fine? And another question is that compared China with Japan. Japan, 25 years ago, the Americans, like the fact in Japan, because Japan was saying that they took over America and so forth. But then 25 years later, we noticed that America is a world power, maybe because they have a producer for Africa.
Well, it's a very interesting country question, which is, given how bad we've been in the past. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. This microphone.
No. Just what it's actually for the people who are asking the questions.
All right, I'll summarize the question then, so that very quickly. Question to simplify it is: are the BRICS a lot of hot air? Because we've seen other projections earlier of emerging economies that don't wind up that well. And how about the fact that we've often misjudged power of countries like Japan and others in the past? Doesn't that give us cause for being more cautious? I would say the answer to that is yes, that we should be more cautious. I mean, I think if you look at Americans in particular tend to think they're in decline every 10 years or so. And in the 19, 50s, the Russians were 10 feet tall, and then the 1980s, the Japanese were 10 feet tall, and now the Chinese are 10 feet tall. China still has a long way to go. I mean, they have the problems of inequality that I mentioned. They have the problems between the East and the West, but also classes in the country. They're also facing a demographic problem of the one-child policy, which means that the increments to the Chinese labor force are going to start tapering off in another year or so. And Chinese themselves worry about what they call growing old as a society before they grow rich. So again, to just project China at 10% growth for another 10, 20 years is simplistic. There'll probably be things that will happen to China. I don't expect China to collapse. I think it's more robust than that. But I don't expect China to continue at the same rate of 10%. For one thing, as countries get to per capita income around $10,000 a year, which in purchasing power parity China will be in the next decade, growth tends to slow down. That happened to Japan. It happens to everybody. So I think your cautionary question is absolutely correct. Yes?
One of the favorite theories used to propose greater global governance is the growth of democracy. Yet, if we take the three key players that you've mentioned, India, China, and the United States, and look at the concentrations of wealth and power, all three are oligarchies in various degrees. So what have you to say in terms of the relationship of global governance? This is one of the reasons why idealists keep arguing the need for world government, so to get away from consolidations of power, etc. So what do you see as the limitations or the opportunities, realistically speaking, for the growth of democracy, which in turn would supposedly support more international governance?
Well, I think I am optimistic about the growth of democracy in the long run, but I don't think that we're going to see world government. If we did, why wouldn't the world government be an oligarchy? But I also think it's a bit too simple to call India and the U.S. oligarchies. If you look at China, it really is a very different political system. India has a caste-based politics in a lot of situations. America has a very heavy involvement of money and regional politics. But it's also worth remembering that the conventional wisdom about the United States in 2007, before the 2008 presidential election, was that you couldn't get to be president of America unless you had a fortune and a family dynasty. And of course, then you elect somebody in 2008, an African American without his own fortune and with a name which sounds funny to most people. That makes it a bit more democratic than just thinking of it as an oligarchy. But I think your basic point is correct, that I think it, with democratic governance, we'll be better placed to have a peaceful network of governance. And I also think that China, as it gets richer, will gradually move in that direction. Not soon, but I think it's very hard to maintain the kind of authoritarian system that China maintains when you get per capita incomes over $10,000, $12,000 a year. Now, the Chinese say, yes, but we have such remaining inequality, we can't afford all this. But if you look at how China's changed during the period of its rapid economic growth in the last 30 years, what an American ambassador, Stapleton Roy, once said, I think is true. They're more Chinese free today than any time in Chinese history. That doesn't make China a free or democratic society. But if you compare 30 years ago government control what you wore, where you lived, whether you could travel abroad, so forth. All that is now freer. So I think that process is likely to continue to change, and I think that I would expect to see a better prospect for democracy over time. Yes.
Yeah, I have a question with regards to India. So you said that China, with a population of its size, has been able to reduce, remove about 300 million people out of poverty. What would you say is the main obstacle that India faces in reducing poverty?
Well, I was in New Delhi in January and met with Mantek Galawalia Singh, who's the head of the Indian, well, he's number two under the Prime Minister on the Indian Planning Commission, and a very bright economist. And I think that the what a sophisticated and Indian economist would tell you, I mean, somebody who's not acting nationalistically, is that India has to overcome this terrible waste of human resources. I mean, the idea of a third of the population illiterate is a huge waste of resources. And you can't support the kind of growth that India needs in the long run just on Bangalore and the information. I mean, that's, you're talking about a percent or so of people. You have to get this growth out to the countryside, to the poorer parts of India. And you also have to, within that, you have to make more use of women as a human resource. I mean, this is just, you just can't afford to waste half your human resources. And so I think that that means that programs to get growth to parts of the countryside, programs to improve educational opportunities, particularly for women, are essential for India's future. But I think Indian economists will tell you that they are working on it. No, this is not something I'm revealing to them. This is something they know, and that they are indeed trying to do something about. But when you try to do something about it, you get into the problems of who benefits which groups, some of the difficulties of having caste-based political systems, which limit things that can be done. You know, some of the lower caste parties bring resources to those areas, but have been extraordinarily corrupt and wasted a lot of these resources. I mean, look at Bihar as an example. So there, you probably know much better than I what the answer to your question is, but I remain optimistic about India in the long run, but there are a lot of very serious obstacles that India has to overcome in the next decade or so. Yes?
You mentioned in your lecture the importance of China developing soft power to be able to become more powerful. I wrote in a paper about Japanese soft power, and I used your arguments about how Japan is not really a soft power. It's really only the U.S. that is a soft power because Japan is reliant on American distribution for to be able to like export its cultural products. So in light of this, in light of the fact that Japan has such cultural appeal, but you still don't consider it as a soft power, how do you think that China should develop to become a soft power?
Well, I think any country has the capacity to develop soft power. In other words, you don't have to be big to have that. India has soft power, which comes from Bollywood, which is... produces more films than Hollywood. Canada has soft power, at least it used to, if the government seemed to think that the soft power is important, through its activity on overseas development assistance and peacekeeping operations and so forth. And Japan, I think what I was arguing is Japan isn't equal in soft power to the U.S., but they have developed some soft power from traditional Japanese culture as well as modern Japanese cultures, anime and so forth. So I think for China, the secret is to unleash their civil society. A lot of soft power is generated not by governments but by civil society. So if you say, where does American soft power comes from? It comes from everything from Hollywood to Harvard to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which spends more money on reducing diseases in Africa than the government does in some areas. I think for China, it has to get away from this idea that the government does everything. China is spending billions of dollars on Confucius Institutes, on increasing, they're trying to create their own Al Jazeera in Chinese and so forth. But the problem with this is it's not fully credible if it's regarded as government propaganda. And when I was in, I gave a lecture in Beijing University, and a student asked me the question you asked, is how can China increase its soft power? And I said, well, consider the comparison with India. India has a global film industry, which attracts many people, and China doesn't. Now, is that because India has better directors, better actors and actresses? No. It's because India doesn't have censors. I said, if you can relax and let your civil society take off, you can greatly increase your soft power. I don't think that was very useful advice, but I think it was the right advice. Yes, way in the back, we have a question by the wall. Yeah.
You talked about the need to develop, to get away from old narratives mm-hmm. and develop new narratives to create more useful institutions to solve world problems. What would it take for countries that are really wary, possessive of its sovereignty, like China and the States, to actually start developing these narratives?
Narratives of cooperation with China or
of cooperation, yes.
Well, I think that we and China should be trying to look for joint projects which are beneficial to both of us. For example, projects in the energy area, which lead to greater energy efficiency, projects which can lower carbon intensity of growth in both countries. In other words, sometimes if you can get a dramatic project, it can often illustrate this capacity for cooperation. But it's also worth remembering that some of the most effective ways to get people to understand each other is face-to-face relations. And the fact that there are 125,000 Chinese students in the United States, and somebody told me 40,000 in Canada, and the fact that the Obama administration is trying to get 100,000 Americans in China, that's also very important. Some dramatic things that a project or two which dramatizes the areas for cooperation, but also knitting societies together with more direct contacts and face-to-face relations. I think both of those are sort of at the high end and the low end are very effective. Yes?
Just this year, China became the leading supplier of wind energy, surpassing the U.S. Do you think this is a positive expression of China's willingness not to free ride on public good and instead provide green energy?
I think China is beginning to take climate change seriously. And that's important and good for all of us. If when you go to China, you can be struck by how bad pollution is in places. Now, carbon dioxide is not a problem of local pollution. This doesn't create the smog you see in the skies. But environment has become one of the areas where civil society in China can develop and where people can do and say things that are critical of the government. And there's been growth of organizations. There people can express opinions on energy. And the government also realizes that if you were to lose the Himalayan glacial system, would be disastrous both for South Asia and East Asia. I mean, in other words, it's in self-interest in the long run. So I think China is beginning to take this seriously. The problem is when you are growing at that rapid a rate, it's nice to have solar and wind, but frankly, it's a drop in the bucket compared to the effect of coal. And as you, and China is well supplied with coal, and they are building 2 new coal-burning plants a week. And so getting greater efforts to do 2 things. One is to use as modern a technology as possible to reduce the CO2 production of these plants, A, and B, to try to move from coal to natural gas, if China were to develop shale gas, for example. These are things which would be much more important than wind or solar, though I'm all in favor of wind and solar. Yes, way in the back.
Thank you for coming to McGill, Professor Noy. Some Chinese scholars claim that China doesn't fit into the international system because they believe that the system is not of their own making, that it's being imposed on them by Western countries who used to be colonial powers. So how would it affect the world system if China decided one day to make their own system? Would it subvert the system that we have now?
Well, there is a strong national ideology of suffering from Western imperialism. So it's a widespread view that from the Opium War further forward that China suffered from Western imperialism. And that is a powerful national myth in China. I don't mean myth means it's wrong. I mean it's a unifying concept. But it doesn't solve, the idea that China could isolate itself just as it has no relationship to economic reality. I mean, the reason that China has been able to have this extraordinarily impressive growth is because it has become the world's largest exporter. And if the Chinese were to cut themselves off to start its own system, presuming it would mean cutting themselves off from the United States, if they did that, it would be a terrible blow to the Chinese economy. Indeed, if one thinks about why is it that the Chinese complain about the Americans all the time in terms of currency, but don't dump their dollars. They hold over $1.3 trillion of dollars. And last year, there was a PLA general who said the Chinese should, if the Americans supplied arms to Taiwan under the Taiwan Relations Act, China should now, it was now strong enough, it should dump its dollars, which would be an example of separating itself out. The central bank of China said, this is absolutely crazy. Do you realize what this will do to our economy? You know, we'll bring the Americans to their knees, but we'll bring ourselves to our ankles. This is, you know, so the practical idea or the idea in practice of implementing the national myth by separation is just not plausible for what China needs, which is a high rate of growth. What China is trying to do now is in the 12th five-year plan is move toward more domestic sources of growth. That's a very important thing, but we're talking about at the margin. You know, a few percent here and there, but not something which, I mean, China can't reduce its dependence on exports and still have the high rate of growth it has. Yes?
To go back to your notion of self-power, earlier you mentioned a relative decline, sorry, everyone. How do you see the future of the U.S. soft power? Especially considering the European Union one at this point in time?
Well, American soft power comes from, or any country's soft power, comes from 3 major sources. One is its culture, where that's attractive to others, its values, when it lives up to its values, and its policies. The Americans are often, their policies are often unattractive. Sometimes they're attractive, sometimes unattractive. Their culture and values tend to stand them in better stead. European soft power grows from the same sources, the attractiveness of European culture, European values. And the Europeans also have the benefit that very often they're not involved with policies that are as unpopular in some areas as American policies. I think Europe probably is closer, to having the same amount of soft power as the United States than most other entities in the world that I can think of. Yes?
To what extent can these new narratives of cooperation you've talked about emerge while the U.S. maintains strong bilateral ties in Japan and Taiwan?
Oh, I think that you're talking about cooperation with China. Yeah, I think that the Taiwan issue has been an irritant and exacerbating U.S.-China relations for a long time, but it may be one of the rare things in international politics which is getting better rather than worse. When Taiwan looked like it was going to try to declare independence under Chen Shui-bian, the DPP president, that could have been a flashpoint for a U.S.-China conflict. Under the new president, Ma Ying-jeou, where they've started cross-strait relations and better economic integration, this danger of secession has gone down. And the American, or Declaration of Independence, properly, formally, has gone down. The American position has been on Taiwan that there should be no Declaration of Independence and there should be no use of force. And within the framework, Beijing and Taipei should negotiate what the relationship would be. And you could imagine over time a relationship which might be called one country, three systems, which is not exactly like Hong Kong, which is one country, two systems, but which gives Taiwan greater freedoms than Hong Kong has. But I think that's not implausible. So that irritant may actually go down. The relationship between the U.S. and Japan need not be an irritant with China. At one point, when I was in the government, I remember meeting with the Chinese defense minister and being told, we don't object to your having troops in Japan. Then he said, for historical reasons. And what he was saying is that when the Americans provide a nuclear umbrella to Japan, Japan is less likely to go nuclear itself, and China worries about that more than the presence of American troops. Now, recently, Japan and China have had a series of spats, particularly on the Senkaku Islands. It's a Chinese called the Diu Islands. I think that's not helpful. My own view is that in the long run, what the Americans want in East Asia is a triangle of good relations between U.S., Japan, and China. Good relations in all three legs of that triangle. And in those circumstances, you're likely to have greater growth, investment, and prosperity than if you have a lot of conflict. So I don't think that the Taiwan and Japan relationships need prevent good relations with China. Yes?
One thing which all countries need is a good, fair, and efficient system of tax, mm-hmm. To tax their people and corporations. And recently the Tobin tax was, no countries were able to reach an agreement on that. Do you see a trend to work towards trying to have more cooperation between countries and to reduce tax havens and have a uniform system of taxes for?
Well, there's been some reduction on tax havens. The OECD has developed a code here, and there's been some enforcement of that. But on a general tax, which would support international development or something of that sort, that, I think, is much less likely. The French have pushed this tax on airplane fuel. There have been some who've said something like a Tobin tax on financial transactions, which could go to UN coffers or so forth. I don't see that happening anytime soon. I mean, it's as I mentioned, not only the U.S., but countries like India, China, many other countries are very jealous of their sovereignty, and setting their own tax rates is a large part of that. Yeah, way in the back on that side.
Sorry.
Either way, whichever goes first.
Okay. I have a question with regard to international environmental governance.
Yes.
In past, the United States has demonstrated unwillingness to compromise its economic competitiveness for a reduced environmental impact. I was wondering if you believe that the United States in future has the potential to be a leader in guiding international environmental governance, and if so, how it should execute such a role.
Well, in the last year or so, things have been going the wrong direction. You remember President Obama was supporting legislation which got through the House of Representatives for a cap-and-trade system. Then in the 2010 elections, he lost the House, and the prospect for legislation like that right now are very slim. So what he's turning to is focusing on energy efficiency, reducing carbon intensity of growth, rather than trying through a cap and trade or gasoline tax and so forth. And ironically, that is similar to the approach which India and China are taking. They say, we don't want a cap, but we are willing to work on reducing carbon intensity. Now, I personally would have preferred that the previous legislation were passed, but the second best, which is to take seriously reduction of carbon intensity, seems to be the next path that looks politically feasible in the next few years. Yes?
You mentioned the need to create new networks of governance to allow nations to negotiate between a fewer number or smaller number. What do you think these new networks would look like, and what would the relationship to existing international organizations look like? Would there be issues of competition because of overlap, or countries being reluctant to enter in new networks where their relative power might be less significant?
Well, the networks that I was talking about will often be overlapping. This is what I meant by this concept of variable geometry. If you look in the area of global finance, for example, you will have situations where there'll be a G7 of global finance ministers. There will be a G20, which is a broader and more inclusive group, which will tend to coordinate and set agendas, but there'll also be the IMF, which has the bureaucracy and the economists to actually work out how these things go. So I think what you're going to wind up with is different types of institutions complementing each other. And, you know, you can add to this the Bank for International Settlements in Basel. There's a whole financial stability forum. There are going to be a network of these different institutions with different sorts of members, and I think you'll see that some of these will perhaps be more useful for some purposes and others for others. But I think that we're not going to see a single framework which is orderly. We're going to see a lot of overlaps and certain messiness in the system. But that's better than no coordination at all. Yes?
I was wondering if you could expand on the situation in North and South Korea. Do you think we're going towards a situation like Germany had in the 1990s?
Well, the Korean Peninsula is very worrisome because you have a situation where the North Korean regime is sort of a leftover Stalinist remnant. You have the anomaly of what might be called the world's first communist monarchy. I mean, they're trying to have it go from Kim Il-sung to Kim Jong-il to Kim Jong-un. We're not there yet, but the tight repression of the system is very different. It really is a leftover. If it were to collapse, the economic differences between North and South Korea are much larger than between East and West Germany. The burdens on South Korea would be much higher. The other point is that the Chinese are very worried about collapse. They don't want North Korea to collapse because they're afraid of chaos on their borders. So if you say, how could you press the North Koreans? The one country that could press them is China. But North Korea has something that I call in my book the power of weakness. Power of weakness is best described by John Maynard Keynes in the 30s, that if you owe a bank £100, the bank has you in its power. If you owe a bank £1 billion, you have the bank in your power. And we saw a bit of this in the recent financial crisis. North Korea, as one Chinese said to me, has hijacked our foreign policy because we can't afford to let them collapse. And the net effect of that is North Korea then can take very dangerous actions, as it did when it sunk the Cheonan ship, South Korean ship, and when it shelled the islands off the coast of South Korea. And it feels that it can get away because China is not going to press them too hard. That's very dangerous. And so I think the North Korean situation is one of the places where I do worry about where things are going.
I think you should probably just take one or two
more
questions.
Okay, one more question.
My question is regarding the intelligence.
Is your mic on?
My question is regarding what you mentioned on inequality, and how would you suggest that countries with such impinged or systematic inequality, like India, address this issue, and how relevant is it for like international governance or for them to become developed nations?
Well, I think it's primarily a domestic issue. I mean, it starts as a domestic issue and domestic stability in the community. But Brazil is an interesting case here. I mean, Brazil has actually reduced the Gini index over the last 10 years. And Brazil has this plan, the Bolsa Família, in which you pay women to keep their children in school and to get immunization. And, you know, that's a good place to start. So there are devices which are, and a number of other countries have ideas like this, but there are devices that can be used to reduce that inequality. India has something a little bit like that, which is guaranteeing work to a certain amount of work per year to rural farmers and so forth. The trouble is it often runs afoul of corruption. The money sometimes doesn't get to the people who need it. So you can think of devices that can help to approach the problems of inequality, but it also takes institutional capacity to put them in place. So I hope, though, that the example of Brazil's Bolsa Família will become something that's more widespread.
So thank you. I'd like to thank the students for posing some really good questions, our audience more broadly there as well. And thank you very much, Professor Nye, for sharing your thoughts with us and giving us this interesting things for us to, I get to build on in my lectures in the next couple of weeks, actually.
Well, thank you all. Now I should disentangle myself here. So they are good questions.